We've always been very bad at predicting the future. Don't believe me? Well, 67 years ago, the ABC asked Australians to do just that, and...
You all commute daily and hourly so fast through space in your private flying saucers.
Global peace and international harmony will be completely attained by the year 2000.
Yeah, still waiting on that world peace. I'm Matt Bevan, and from if you're listening, this is Black Swans, a series about the events we can't see coming, no matter how hard we try. It's available now on ABC Listen.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are advised that this episode contains the name of an Aboriginal person who has died. One of the men at the centre of this story can't speak. The other one, Zachary Rolfe, spent days telling a courtroom what happened on that night in Yuendumu. This is what he said and what his jury decided. I'm Stephen Stockwell. Welcome to Chapter 3 of the case of Kumanjai Walker.
Constable Zachary Rolfe fatally shot the 19-year-old.
Sometimes I think about how he must have felt in his last moments. Was he scared?
And I can promise you, consequences will flow.
Constable Rolfe has pleaded not guilty to one charge of murder.
Prosecutors took the case to the High Court.
There's been a huge outpouring of grief.
An organisation with significant hallmarks of institutional racism.
When we are going to get justice? When?
The shooting in Yuendumu in 2019 had this huge impact across Australia. Zachary Rolfe was charged with murder following the shooting of Kumanjai Walker, something that is incredibly rare. It is so unusual for a police officer to be charged with murder when they are working. Melissa McKay was there for all of this, living in Darwin, covering this murder trial. Melissa, how was Darwin coping with this?
There was a really strange sense of anxiety, I think, across all of the Northern Territory during this, what was supposed to be a four, which ended up being almost 6-week trial, but also in the lead up to it. People had really strong opinions on both sides of this case, and that was really palpable as this trial was going on.
In our last episode, we took you through that trial. We started at the beginning, heard how the evidence was presented, and finished on the question of whether or not Zachary Rolfe was going to give evidence in his own murder trial, because he doesn't have to, but he decides he will. He makes this decision to get in the witness box. What was that day like?
I remember this day so clearly because no one knew what was going to happen. And I remember walking into court that morning and the usual sort of good mornings and hellos from the defence team in particular just weren't there. They were really silent. They were really standoffish. I assumed that I had published something the night before that was wrong and that I was about to get in trouble for something that might then throw this whole case out. But then later that afternoon, when Zachary Rolfe was called to the witness box, that's when I realised why everyone had been so anxious that morning.
How did that moment unfold?
The Crown closed their case and the defence quite simply called Zachary Rolfe to give evidence.
The lack of drama in court sometimes really surprises me. I mean, you know, there's this huge anticipation on whether or not Zachary Rolfe is going to give evidence. So many people want to hear what he has to say. And then he ends up in the witness box by such a simple procedure. What was he like in there?
It was really interesting to watch Zachary Rolfe giving evidence because this was the first time anyone had ever heard what his voice sounded like. It was the first time anyone had really heard what he, you know, seen his mannerisms and that sort of thing. And he was really calm. He was confident in the witness box. He made eye contact with the lawyers who were asking him questions. He made eye contact with the jury.
And while we hear a lot from Rolfe about his side of the story, It's when he talks about his gun that people really start to pay attention, right?
Yeah, there was something he said about the moment that he reached for his gun that surprised almost everyone in the room, I think. Zachary Rolfe said that Kumanjayi Walker's hand was on his Glock during the struggle. He said that when he reached to pull out his weapon, that Kumanjayi's hand was already there. And that is a massive thing for a police officer to be in that moment, I guess, almost at risk of losing control of their service weapon. So that was something we had never heard before. That hadn't come out during the committal hearings. That hadn't been suggested at all during the rest of the evidence that we'd heard through this weeks-long trial. And so that was really shocking to hear that come from Zachary Rolfe in that moment. And he really stood firm in his evidence that he was in fear for his life when he reached for his Glock.
Mel, in our last episode, you were talking about how there was this kind of reliance of training presented as the defence argument, that, you know, Zachary Rolfe was just kind of following his training. Was that something that he spoke to much when he was giving evidence?
Absolutely. When I talk about how he was quite methodical in his evidence, it was almost as if he was seeing the jury as a classroom where he could teach them about his police training. You know, there were a number of occasions where his lawyer would ask him a question about something that he was trained to do, and he would suggest, oh, would you like me to explain that to the jury? Or he would use a police speak or some sort of acronym and then very helpfully explain that to the jury and what that meant. And so this is a police officer who had duxed his class when he was in the academy. And so he had this aura of, you know, authority, I suppose, when it came to what his training was and what he had learnt on the job in Alice Springs, which he sort of made quite clear that he felt that policing in Alice Springs was different to, you know, what some of the senior police officers up in Darwin who hadn't been out on the road in Alice Springs in a long time, you know, that they didn't know what it was like anymore.
Yeah, right. I mean, talking about his training, I mean, the way you've described him kind of educating the jury is fascinating. I mean, when you have anybody in the witness box, you have evidence in chief and then you have a cross-examination. And the evidence in chief is, you know, often done by the prosecution. But in the case of a defence witness, that is, you know, it's Zachary Rolfe's defence team. They're asking these questions and it's often a kind of much gentler approach. You know, they're looking to coax out things that will aid his defence, basically. But then you have the cross-examination, the prosecution going in there and challenging Zachary Rolfe's version or evidence. How did that unfold?
There were some tense moments, and you're right in saying that the defence or examination in chief, when it's a defence witness, is a bit of a softer approach, because Zachary Rolfe was very calm and methodical and clear when he was giving his evidence in chief, but there were a few moments that got quite tense with Philip Strickland SC. And the Crown was essentially trying to get Zachary Rolfe to concede that he was lying when he said that he was in fear of his life and his partner's life when he fired those fatal shots, keeping in mind that the prosecution has already conceded that that first shot was legally justified. Their whole murder case rested on that 2.6 seconds between the first shot and the second shot, and, you know, the half a second between the second and third. Their argument was that the circumstances had changed drastically in those moments. And so they were trying to get Zachary Rolfe to concede that the situation had changed, that he was no longer in fear for his life or his partner's life in those seconds, and that he didn't follow his training. The Crown also had this argument around what Zachary Rolfe said after the fact. They were trying to get Zachary Rolfe to concede that when he said, he was stabbing you, he was stabbing me, after the shooting, explaining to his partner, Adamie Burl, why he had fired those shots. The Crown was essentially trying to get Zachary Rolfe to concede that he'd said that for the purposes of the body-worn camera footage, that he was essentially trying to say that to justify what he had just done. Because you can hear it in the footage, Adamy Birl doesn't really realise until after the fact that shots have been fired. You can hear him say, oh, did you just, and then he swears, realising that shots have just been fired. And that's when Zachary Rolfe says, it's okay, it's all good, he was stabbing you, he was stabbing me. So the Crown's case there was that Zachary Rolfe was saying that because he knew it was going to be caught on the body-worn footage.
Yeah, right. And that leads to the end of all of the evidence when he finishes speaking. We then move into, you know, the closing arguments, directions from the judge, the kind of the final moments and final stages of a trial. And this is where you have basically the parties, you know, the Crown, the prosecutors and the defence team kind of bringing together all the evidence that a jury has heard over the last however many weeks, 6 weeks in this trial, explaining what they say that evidence says. You know, the Crown goes first in these closings in most states and territories around Australia and in the Northern Territory. What was theirs like? What was the story that they were telling?
The Crown closing was quite long and almost tedious, some could say, because what they're doing is reiterating every point of the case that they have just spent weeks presenting to the jury. They were arguing that Rolfe wasn't following his training when he went into that house, when he pulled out his gun. They argued that he knew that Kumanjayi Walker had been restrained by Adamy Birl on the ground when he fired those second and third shots. They argued that he had put his hand on Adamy Birl to make sure that he didn't shoot his partner when he went to fire those fatal shots. They reiterated that he had allegedly lied for the purposes of the body-worn camera footage, and Philip Strickland argued that he had said this to justify the unjustifiable, to justify the shooting, and in the Crown's case, to justify murder.
Right. And you say it was long and tedious. What we see in these kind of closing arguments is the reference to evidence that we've heard throughout the trial. You know, you have witness X that have said this, you've seen this other piece of evidence, and when you put them together, we say that says this, kind of drawing these conclusions and pointing the jury in the direction that, you know, the Crown says shows that Zachary Rolfe committed murder. On the other side, you have the defence team. You know, they don't need to prove that Zachary Rolfe didn't. They just need to prove that there is a reasonable doubt that he committed or didn't commit these acts, that he didn't commit murder. How did they frame this? What were they talking about?
The defence really relied heavily on this knife equals gun argument, something that David Edwardson brought up in his opening address that he said to the jury at the beginning would loom large over this trial, and it did. He really reiterated that police are trained that when they are presented with an edged weapon or threatened with an edged weapon, that they are trained to draw their gun. And that is exactly what Zachary Rolfe did in that moment, that he had been stabbed in the shoulder, a wound which David Edwardson argued could have been lethal had it been any closer to his neck or had it gone any deeper. He really reiterated that Zachary Rolfe was a good cop just trying to do his job on the night. He said that the officer was unaware of this planned 5 a.m. arrest, which we heard in the previous episode had been planned to happen the following morning. You know, he argued that that plan was really unclear and that Zachary Rolfe and his colleagues, you know, weren't aware of this 5 a.m. plan. The defence narrative essentially throughout the trial and particularly through the closing was to paint Kumanjayi Walker as a deadly threat to this police officer and his partner, and that Zachary Rolfe did what he had to do to protect himself and his partner. David Edwardson said in his closing that Kumanjayi Walker was dangerous and in many ways, he said, the author of his own misfortune.
Hmm. Can you give me an insight into the kind of theatre in the room at this moment as well? You know, these closings can be quite dramatic. You know, you have these barristers talking directly to the jury. You know, this is their final moment in this presentation. I mean, was this as dramatic and theatrical as I kind of imagine it was, or was it a bit more straight down the line?
It was pretty dramatic. Different barristers have different styles. And I think I spoke about this earlier. David Edwardson has quite a theatrical style. He speaks to the jury like he's telling a story. So his closing had this through line of Zachary Rolfe being a good cop who was just trying to do his job, who had been threatened by this dangerous criminal. And he really reiterated that at every point he possibly could. The Crown also had this through line throughout their closing, but was perhaps a little bit less theatrical and more methodical in terms of taking the jury through all of the evidence that they had been presented, that Zachary Rolfe hadn't followed his training, that the circumstances had changed in that 2.6 seconds between the first and second shot, and that the second and third shots were not legally justified, that they were murder, and that Zachary Rolfe was reckless about following his training.
Mm. And, you know, we go from the drama of these closings to the very clinical, very dry judge's directions where, you know, the judge will sit and talk to the jury about how they need to consider the law in their judgment, like what they need to be considering, what weight they should put on evidence as well, and all of those things. And this is the last thing the jury hears before they go away to deliberate. Do you think there's anything that would have stuck in their mind from the judge's directions as they went away to deliberate?
I think there would have been a few key points. And obviously, having not been in the jury room, I can't say for sure what would have stuck with jurors from Burns J's summary. But you're right. Judges' summaries of these cases can be quite long. They can be quite tedious because it is the judge's job to summarize everything that they've just heard over several weeks and, you know, to sort of recap the main points. And so I remember this summary taking quite some time. But there were a few things I think that would have stuck out, including, you know, reminding the jury that this case was not about the first shot, that the Crown had conceded that the first shot was legally justified and that might be something that they think about. He also recapped, you know, the limitations of body-worn video that we had heard so much about throughout the trial. And he really reiterated that this was going to come down to what they thought of Zachary Rolfe's state of mind in that moment, that it was whether or not he believed that he was acting in defense of himself and his partner. He said that there had been a lot of discussion around the scissors that Kumanjai Walker had used to stab Zachary Rolfe in the shoulder with, and there was a lot of conjecture over whether or not that weapon could have been lethal in that moment. Burns J reminded jurors that that wasn't necessarily critical to their decision-making and that it was all about Zachary Rolfe's state of mind when he fired those shots, whether he believed he was defending himself and his partner in the line of duty.
Mm. And, I mean, these directions finish. His last thought that the jury has as they're walking away to consider the verdict. And this is a really tense time. Everyone is waiting for this decision. What was it like being around the court, just waiting to hear what was going to happen?
It's really difficult to describe the feeling of waiting for a jury. This is something that, you know, that I've done 100 times as a court reporter. You never know how long the jury is going to take. You never know whether they're going to come back with a question or, you know, what they're thinking. It's so hard to predict. And so there's this kind of indescribable sense of anxiety around the courtroom But particularly with a case like this that had so much resting on it, it was unlike any other jury deliberation I have ever sat through.
How long did it take?
It took them about 7 hours, but this went overnight. So the jury deliberated for the afternoon, and then we all came back into court. They were released, and then they came back the next morning. And I can't imagine what that night would have been like for the jurors, for Kumanjayi Walker's family, for Zachary Rolfe and his family. I actually ran into Zachary Rolfe's mum. This is, you know, how small Darwin is. I ran into Zachary Rolfe's mum the next morning when the jury ultimately came back. And, you know, we had a polite, hi, how are you kind of moment. And she just looked at me and she said, Mel, I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy. You know, in that moment, you kind of have this realization of like the human element for everyone involved in this. You know, this is a mum who's watching her son on trial for murder. You know, I don't imagine that that's a situation she ever expected herself to be in. And then you talk to members of Kumanjayi Walker's family who have travelled so far to sit in this courtroom, and they've put so much trust in this system that is so foreign and is so far away from home. There's a jury of 12 people who have so much of their hopes resting in their hands.
Mm. The amount of time between a jury kind of making their decision and going back into the room to announce it is pretty short. Like, you don't get a lot of warning. You know, once you heard that the jury had reached a decision, Mel, what was it like getting back in there to hear what decision they'd reached?
It was absolute mayhem trying to get into the courtroom, because as soon as, you know, there were whispers through the court precinct that the jury had come back with a verdict, not with a question, not with clarification, but with a verdict, everyone in the vicinity wanted to be in that courtroom. And there were only so many seats. And so there was members of Kumanjayi Walker's family trying to get into the room. There were members of the media trying to get into the room, supporters of Zachary Rolfe trying to get into the room, and every other lawyer who just happened to be in the court precinct at that time wanted to be there to hear the jury's verdict. It was really, really intense, and I don't even really remember sort of exactly what I was thinking or feeling in that moment waiting for the jury to deliver their verdict, because I'm thinking about having to file this story and get this news out there as quickly as possible while there are two families here whose futures really rest in what the jury has to say.
What did they have to say? What verdict did they reach?
Not guilty on all three counts. So that was not guilty of murder, not guilty of manslaughter, and not guilty of engaging in a violent act causing death.
What was the reaction in the room?
It was kind of an eerie silence, to be honest. You know, Zachary Rolfe and his family were sort of almost directly in front of me. They hugged each other and hugged their lawyer. He hugged his lawyers, and his lawyers were hugging his parents. And, you know, there was this obvious sense of relief for them. And then on the other side of the courtroom, Kumanjayi Walker's family were clearly crushed, and they sort of filed very silently out of the courtroom and into the foyer of the Supreme Court, and they were just wailing.
did we hear anything from either Zachary Rolfe or from Kumanjayi Walker's family following the verdict? Like, you know, talking about, you know, hearing the reactions from that room is just so visceral. And, you know, I'm imagining that, but I'm also imagining the kind of like the media crush as well. Like, there would have been a wall of cameras outside of this building waiting for people to emerge. Did anybody say anything?
Absolutely. A wall is a really excellent way of putting it, because that's exactly what it was. There was this wall of cameras in front of the front doors of the Supreme Court. No one was going to be able to get out of that building without being stopped. Zachary Rolfe and his team were the first to leave the courthouse. They came up to the cameras, which had been set up. We'd all put our microphones out, ready to catch whatever was going to be said. And the police union spoke, his lawyers spoke, and then Zachary Rolfe spoke.
Obviously, I think that was the right decision to make, but a lot of people are hurting today, Kumanjayi's family and his community, and we need to get to this point, so I'm going to leave this space for them.
Zachary Rolfe on the steps of the Darwin Supreme Court following the not guilty verdict in his murder trial. Mel, did we hear anything from Kumanjayi Walker's family?
Kumanjayi Walker's family spoke for about 45 minutes on the steps of the court. It was very emotional. There were several speakers who talked about the difficulty of the last couple of years while they were waiting for this trial to happen, while they were dealing with not only the grief of losing a loved one, for some of them who had been there that night witnessing the shooting, waiting for police to tell them what had happened to Kumanjayi on that night. And then for the stop and start for this trial, which had taken so long to get to this point, they really reiterated the trauma and the difficulty that they had been through over the last couple of years, and the difficulty of seeing what was being reported about their loved one versus what they remembered of him.
After 5 exhausting weeks, we have finally heard the jury's decided verdict. We are deeply saddened by the result and cannot put our grief into words. Kumanjayi was only 19 years old when he died at the police station of Yindamu after being shot 3 times by Zachary Rolfe. That is a fact and that cannot be disputed. He died without his family's support, even though we stood just outside begging to come in to see if he was okay. He was rejected the opportunity to be comforted in his last moments, and we were robbed of the opportunity to say goodbye to him. We are deeply disappointed, and though we've been given a trial, I can't with honesty say that it's been fair. We will return home and we'll continue our healing process, but this is not the last you will hear from Kumanjayi's family.
That's Samara Fernandez-Brown, the cousin of Kumanjayi Walker, speaking on the steps of the Darwin Supreme Court after Zachary Rolfe's not guilty verdict. And Mel, we've spoken a lot about the families of both Kumanjayi Walker and Zachary Rolfe throughout this episode and this series, but I mean, this was felt so much more broadly. What kind of reaction to this decision did we see around the country?
It was really torn, the response to the verdict. You know, on one hand, you had supporters of Zachary Rolfe, including the Northern Territory Police Association, the union which had backed him this entire time, arguing that the prosecution should never have happened, arguing that there had been political interference in the charges being laid in the first place, that Zachary Rolfe had been viciously and brutally stabbed while trying to do his job, and then he'd been prosecuted for following his training. And then on the other side, you had Kumanjayi Walker's family and supporters of the Yindamu community, who viewed Kumanjayi Walker as an innocent victim of police brutality, that Zachary Rolfe was a callous killer who had just gotten away with murder. There were two very binary views of what had taken place in the Northern Territory Supreme Court over those few weeks, and there wasn't really a whole lot of space for nuance in this conversation and in the Supreme Court itself.
Mm. And, I mean, something I've noticed about court processes themselves is that, you know, our lives don't exist in a kind of vacuum, but often what gets looked at in court is this small section of somebody's life, and the specifics around that moment are what's interrogated. But there's so much that contributed to the shooting of Kumanjayi Walker. It wasn't just Zachary Rolfe going into Yuendamu on that day. There are things about Australia, about society, about the police, about Yuendamu that feed into this. And in our next episode, we're going to start exploring what some of them are, because that's what the inquest into this death started to examine, the sort of the bigger picture, the broader reasoning around that. But before we get there, Mel, you know, as I've kind of hinted at, there's a lot that doesn't go before a jury because of the rules of a court. What were some of the things that the jury didn't know, that they didn't hear when they were making this decision?
Absolutely. There were a series of what's called pieces of tendency evidence that the prosecution had tried to put before the jury. Essentially, they had tried to argue that Zachary Rolfe had a tendency to use violence against Aboriginal men. And in trying to prove that point, they presented the judge with a series of earlier interactions by Zachary Rolfe with Aboriginal men in and around Alice Springs, where he had used force, where the prosecutors were arguing that he had used excessive force and that this was a pattern of behaviour. Tendency evidence is really difficult to get in to a trial, and it wasn't allowed in this case. There were also a couple of text messages which were found on Zachary Rolfe's phone, one which, you know, referred to policing in Alice Springs as cowboy shit. And that also wasn't allowed in. That also wasn't put to the jury. And so after the trial finished, there had been suppression orders over that evidence. This was something that journalists knew about well before the trial had started, but because it hadn't been allowed in, we weren't allowed to report on it. And so then when the trial ended, it meant that the media had to go back to court and argue for those suppression orders to be lifted so that we could report on those earlier incidents.
Yeah, right. And Mel, why wasn't that evidence allowed?
Well, the judge ruled that those incidents were too far removed from the night of the 9th of November 2019, that they had happened months earlier and that the circumstances were so different to what happened on the night Kumanjayi Walker was killed, that they just simply weren't relevant, and that if the prosecution wanted to use that evidence, they were essentially going to then have to run multiple trials within a trial to prove those incidents as well.
Right, okay. I mean, yeah, the thing I find kind of fascinating about court process is just the number of rules around evidence. What is allowed, what isn't allowed, what a jury can consider, what a jury, you know, shouldn't have in their mind when they're making their decision. It's one of the reasons that the restrictions around court reporting are so tight, so that, you know, the jury doesn't end up thinking about things that they're not supposed to be considering in those moments.
Exactly. And it's all designed, you know, in order to give the accused access to a fair trial.
Yeah. And I mean, there are rules around what evidence is and isn't allowed into a court, but I always think of juries when they would read these stories, the stories that are written afterwards, the things that they weren't able to consider when making their decision. And again, there are really good reasons for why they're not able to consider that. Things have to fit very specific rules of law and rules of evidence to be discussed. And I mean, Mel, that all does come out though, following the shooting of anyone, following any death in custody, there is an inquest. There's a long investigation into what happened, and this and so much more is kind of what ends up coming out of the kind of the process that follows this trial, right?
Yeah, there's a mandatory coronial inquest that follows any death in custody. And this was set as the longest coronial inquest the Northern Territory has ever seen, and it started 6 months after Zachary Rolfe was acquitted.
In our next episode, we're going to take you into that inquest. it goes so much further than the trial of Zachary Rolfe, really looking at why Kumanjayi Walker was shot on that night in Yuendamu. And some of the revelations, some of the things that came out are really kind of incredible. We'll have all the details of them in our next episode. And we're also planning to answer your questions in our final episode of this series as well. So if there's anything you'd like Mel or I to answer, please get in touch. thecaseof@abc.net.au. And we'll be back in your feed on Thursday. The Case of Kumanjayi Walker is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. It's reported by Melissa McKay and presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller, and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. Thank you to senior lawyer Jasmine Sims and to senior cultural advisor Miriam Corowa for their help making this series. This episode was produced on the land of the Gadigal, Turrbal, and Wurundjeri people.